In actual fact, before we actually get started, what I think we forgot to add in the previous episode is that both of us are not examiners.
Oh, yes. Yep. We should mention that.
I think that's very important. Just in case we get the examiners listening in and saying, oh, look, I wouldn't have done it this way. So I do apologize to all the examiners out there. We are just going by how we think, and we're just doing our best.
That's right. Which is, you know, humility, and also the fact that, I mean, most candidates will get examined by non-examiners for the majority of the time. So I guess we're just providing this extra resource that most people are going to anyway.
Now, no, and, you know, to give credit to the examiners, they put in a lot of work. They actually go through a lot of training, and they have, you know, the skills and the mechanisms to vive a candidate professionally. Whereas what we do is we're just doing it on the fly, aren't we?
Yeah, we're just asking questions. We've got a bit of knowledge, and we spend a lot of time on this, which is probably an advantage for us, but we don't have the inside story yet. But wait till we get some examiners on.
That's
here.
That's right. Yeah. Correct. So if there's any examiners out there who want to come onto our podcast, we'd love to have you on. And in fact, I think trainees would love to have you on and really get an insight in terms of the inner workings of the exam.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, I think, you know, the examiners definitely want you to pass. Everyone wants you to pass. It's like this hurdle that we want you to get through to make sure that the standard of Australian enesis is exceptional. And, you know, I think the amount of work that people put in every department, in the examination, in the ANSCA committee, the work that everyone puts in to get people to pass is incredible. I can't imagine the hours, the cumulative hours that we put in and the candidates put in and study. It's a lot of work.
I gotta hold you up on a point. You only mentioned Australia. Now you have to know that about over 20% of our audience is from New Zealand.
Oh, yes.
So very important that we also recognize the New Zealand trainees who support this podcast.
And the listeners from the UK.
And the listeners from the UK, as well as there's a little bit of Asia.
Yep.
And I think we've got a country from Africa.
Maybe ANSCA should change their name to WANSCA.
The world.
Australia and New Zealand. We've
got that reach.
That's right.
All right, Pat. Okay. You ready for your second viva?
Let's do it, guys.
Oh, hold on. I've got to do the intro, don't I?
Oh, yes.
So, everyone, welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break. And again, this is another very special episode because we are continuing to viva Pat, who's very kindly offered to, you know, be subjected to an examination in public, online, and downloadable by pretty much anyone in the world who's interested in pharmacology and physiology. So thanks again, Pat. And yeah, we'll get started with the second viva for you.
All right, Pat.
Sounds good.
All right. How does heparin work?
Okay. So heparin is an anticoagulant drug. It works via reversible binding to antithrombin 3. Heparin causes a conformational change to antithrombin 3, resulting in a thousandfold increase in its activity. This causes markedly increased binding between antithrombin 3 and both factor 10 and thrombin. This causes thrombin and factor 10 inactivation and the overall anticoagulation effect.
Good. What's the antidote to heparin?
It's protamine.
And how does protamine work?
So protamine acts via...
That's okay.
I can't remember the mechanism, but it acts in a dose of 100 to 1 in terms of its heparin to protamine ratio.
Okay, that's okay. How about low molecular weight heparin? How does that work?
Yeah, so low molecular weight heparin reversibly binds to antithrombin 3 also causes a conformational change in this endogenous protein. However, because it's a smaller drug molecule, it has reduced effect on antithrombin 3 binding to thrombin when compared to unfractionated heparin. Therefore, it preferentially inhibits factor 10 in a ratio of about 4 to 1 versus its inhibition of thrombin.
Okay. Now, why do we monitor unfractionated heparin but not low molecular weight heparin?
So unfractionated heparin has a narrower therapeutic index. Therefore, without monitoring, it's at a high risk of either underdosing and therefore clotting risk, or overdosing and causing adverse bleeding events. This is due to the fact that unfractionated heparin has high protein binding, resulting in a variable plasma concentration and therefore unpredictable effective dose, resulting in large individual variability with the doses. So that's why we monitor heparin compared to low molecular weight.
And how do we monitor unfractionated heparin's effects?
So that's by your activated partial thromboplastin time, or APTT.
And how is the clearance of unfractionated heparin different to that of low molecular weight heparin?
Unfractionated heparin is metabolized by liver heparinases with inactive metabolites renally excreted. Conversely, low molecular weight heparins are minimally metabolized by hepatic heparinases, therefore predominantly excreted unchanged by the kidneys. Therefore, that's why you need to renally adjust doses for low molecular weight heparin.
Now, you've got a patient on warfarin and you're thinking of bridging them onto low molecular weight heparin. What are the pharmacological considerations that you need to consider?
So the pharmacological considerations, you need to consider why the patient's on warfarin and the operation they're having. You need to consider the patient's liver function and renal function in terms of the clearance of warfarin and when you're recommencing your and when you're commencing your bridging therapy.
So tell me about some of the principles of that.
So that has to do with, I guess, the duration of action of warfarin after the last dose, which is to do with its protein binding and co-administered medications as well, which influence the degree of protein binding of warfarin. And this is to do, and also just the clearance of warfarin also, I guess.
So how many days would you need to wait before you started a low molecular weight heparin therapy?
Generally about 3 days, I believe. And this is to do with the half-life of warfarin.
The half-life of warfarin or the half-life of something else?
So the half-life of the clotting factors that have already been inhibited by warfarin.
Okay, good. Now, what are the main differences between intracellular and extracellular iron concentrations?
So the main differences are the major cations and anions at play. So the major intracellular cation is potassium, the concentration of about 150 millimoles per litre, with extracellular potassium being much lower, approximately 5 millimoles per litre. The major extracellular cation is sodium, about 140 millimoles per litre, with intracellular sodium much lower, about, I think, 10 to 20 millimoles per litre. Conversely, the major extracellular anion is chloride, concentration about 110 millimoles per litre, and an intracellular concentration about half that at 60 millimoles per litre. Conversely, the major intracellular anion effect is due to organic anions and proteins.
Okay. What is the function of potassium?
Potassium is a key component in the sodium-potassium pump, which is a major mechanism facilitating cellular excitability in a number of different cells in the body. Potassium has a role in regulating cell membrane potentials and facilitating action potential propagation. It maintains cellular tonicity through its high intracellular concentration, and I think it also regulates some intracellular protein synthesis and intracellular processes.
Okay. Which ion is the most important in the contribution to resting membrane potential?
Sodium.
Okay. And what is the nurse potential?
So nurse potential refers to the charge across the cell membrane. So the nurse equation describes a potential difference across the cell membrane caused by a single ion when this ion is at its equilibrium.
And do you know what the nurse potential of potassium is?
So quite low, yes. I would assume.
Yes.
I would say minus 80 millivolts.
Yep.
I don't know.
Good.
Yep.
And do you know what normal resting membrane potential is?
So it depends on the cell, but for, say, a neural cell, minus 70 millivolts.
Yeah. So do you know what the nurse potential of sodium is?
Yeah, so it's positive, about positive 20 to 30 millivolts.
Okay, a little bit more, but that's okay.
Okay.
So knowing the nurse potential of sodium and potassium, which one's close to the resting membrane potential?
So sodium. The resting membrane potential potassium, sorry.
Yes. Okay. So it's actually potassium that has more relevance to resting membrane potential. Now, what are the ECG changes you would expect in hyperkalemia?
So there's a variable depending on the severity of hyperkalemia. So it starts with being characterized by elevated T waves and shortening of the QT interval and prolongation of the PR interval. This is followed by flattening of the P wave and progressive widening of the QRS complex until it descends into a sinusoidal shape and broad ventricular fibrillation or asystole.
And do you know the mechanism and on how hyperkalemia causes these changes?
So it would interfere with action potential generation and propagation at your sinoatrial and atrioventricular nodes. And it would also, hyperkalemia would also impair depolarization of your ventricular myocytes also. Basically, if the extracellular potassium level is increasing substantially, it interferes with, I guess, the
Just quickly, does hyperkalemia, does it make your cell hyperpolarized or hypopolarized?
Hold on. Sorry.
That's okay.
Well, yeah.
So those were the first two stems. So for the third stem, what are the functions of the placenta?
Okay. So the placenta facilitates the exchange of gases, oxygen and carbon dioxide between the maternal and fetal circulations. It enables transfer of nutrients from the mother to the fetus and transfer of waste from the fetus to the mother. It produces important pregnancy-mediating hormones and has a role in immunology for the mother and for the fetus.
Sounds good. That's a good summary. Tell me, how is the placenta different to the lung?
So in terms of gas exchange, so they're both gas exchanging organs and tissues, but the placenta has firstly a much smaller surface area and a much thicker transcellular membrane compared to the lung. So looking at fixed laws of diffusion, there's much less efficient gas exchange by the placenta versus the lung.
What is fixed law of diffusion?
So fixed law of diffusion is the relationship between the sort of rate of diffusion and the factors that affect it. So that's the concentration gradient multiplied by the surface area divided by the thickness of the membrane and the molecular weight multiplied by the molecular weight of the substance that's being diffused across.
With the molecular weight, what is the exact multiplication? So the factors there would be solubility and molecular weight.
Yep.
Tell me about.
Sorry, I'm not sure what you're asking there.
That's right. Is it proportional to molecular weight or inversely proportional? Is it proportional to solubility?
So it is proportional to solubility and inversely proportional to the molecular weight.
Beautiful. And that would be the square root of molecular weight?
Yes.
Let's see, what are the comparisons, area and thickness versus the lung? Approximate numbers.
So in terms of specific numbers, it's much, much thicker in terms of its membrane thickness. So I would say between 5 to 10 times thicker, I believe. And I think in terms of surface area, similar numbers are coming in my head, that it's maybe 10 times less surface area.
Yeah, that's right. Around 10 square meters versus 100 square meters are kind of two numbers worthwhile. Thinking about thickness, what do you think?
Thickness, I thought it was a similar ballpark of about maybe 5 times as thick, maybe 3 to 5 times.
Yeah, 3.5 micrometers versus 0.5. And as you mentioned, you know, it's disadvantage in terms of transfer of these substances. Now, how are substances transferred across the placenta?
So simple diffusion. So gases like oxygen and carbon dioxide just simply diffuse across the cell membranes. Mm-hmm. You can have facilitated diffusion via transport proteins for substances like glucose through the GLUT1 transporter protein. Substances can be transported via transcytosis, such as immunoglobulins, where they're endocytosed by cells at one surface, transported across the cell in a vesicle and exocytosed into the fetal circulation. It can be through active transport and also through, I guess, bulk flow, if you're considering the movement of water through its osmotic gradient.
Now, what are the factors that affect transfer of oxygen across the placenta?
So we have to consider oxygen delivery to the placenta, therefore maternal blood oxygen content, which is determined by the oxygen flux equation and the perfusion of the placenta, mm-hmm. which is influenced by the uterine artery supply and cardiac output. And then we consider, I guess, factors at the placenta that influence oxygen transfer. These include a high maternal and fetal partial pressure gradient facilitating oxygen transfer, mm-hmm. The higher fetal oxygen affinity. This is secondary to the presence of fetal hemoglobin and its unique serine substitution on the beta chain of the globin unit. Mm-hmm. It's relatively high fetal hemoglobin levels compared to an adult, which increases oxygen binding capacity and also maintains, I guess, a transfer gradient from the mother to the fetus and the double bore effect.
Fantastic. Now on to the next stem. During anesthesia, you notice a difference between the end-tidal CO2 and arterial CO2. What is the cause of this difference, and what can you do to minimize this difference?
So end-tidal and arterial CO2. So this difference is secondary to your alveolar dead space. This is physiological, and the normal difference is 2 to 5 millimeters of mercury. Mm-hmm. Reducing alveolar dead space can be done via a number of means. These include increasing your tidal volume and decreasing your respiratory rate. So larger volume, slow breaths facilitate emptying of your alveoli with slower time constants. Mm-hmm. Also, I guess what you can do is ensure adequate global pulmonary perfusion. So you're minimising the alveoli, which are ventilated but not perfused.
Now, how do you... So give me a definition, sorry, for physiological dead space.
So physiological dead space is a combination, is the summation of anatomical and alveolar dead space. Mm-hmm. And it is defined as areas of the lung which are ventilated but are not perfused. So I'm not involved in gas.
Great. And how do, you measure physiological dead space?
Physiological, was it?
Yeah, physiological.
Yep. So physiological dead space is measured by the Bohr equation. So the Bohr equation is defined as the volume of dead space, or the ratio of dead space to the tidal volume, is equal to your partial pressure of alveolar oxygen.
Alveolar
carbon dioxide, yes, minus your partial pressure of mixed expired carbon dioxide divided by your partial pressure of alveolar carbon dioxide. Fantastic. And the normal ratio is 0.2 to 0.3, I think.
Sounds good. And now, when you take the p-alveolar CO2, we can't really measure that. So what do we do?
So you do a modification, the Inghoff modification, and you substitute arterial carbon dioxide.
Sounds good. Now, how do you measure anatomical dead space?
So that's measured by Fowler's method, Fowler's nitrogen washout test. Mm-hmm. Would you like me to describe?
Yeah, describe it. That briefly. Method.
Yep. So it's a nitrogen washout test. The patient has a mouthpiece connected to a gas sampling line and a nitrogen analyzer. They're breathing normally and then breathe a single breath of 100% oxygen. They have a normal exhalation, and the expired nitrogen is measured from the start of this exhalation. This is graphed on a concentration versus volume exhaled curve. Mm-hmm. And the anatomical dead space is inferred from the volume at which the area, when the nitrogen curve starts rising, at the point that, at the midpoint of this curve, I can draw the curve, but I don't know how to translate.
That's fine. It's where
the area A equals area B.
That's right. You can always see this in West, where you have area A and B as the first slope increases. And you're right, that's the point at which you'd be able to determine roughly where anatomical dead space is. Now, what are the measurements you initially use, when you're using Fowler's method? What type of instruments are you using to measure?
So you're using a mouthpiece connected to a gas sampling line. Yes. I guess is it a body plethysmography?
Not for this one, no. But you're right. You have to have some kind of gas analysis device. So yep, a rapid nitrogen analyzer can be used for that. And how do you measure these volumes? And you mentioned volumes. How do you measure that?
So it would be with a spirometer.
Yeah, that's right. So it's and so you can use a spirometer for flow. And then often you can integrate with respect to time to get the volumes, and that's how it occurs. And that is time. Fantastic. How do you feel?
Extremely relieved that it is finished.
any thoughts on how you feel about this one compared to the one you did previously?
I don't think so. Just for the listeners, we're recording it on the same.
Hold on.
Oh, sorry.
You can't let the secrets out of the bag.
Okay.
No.
Okay, no worries. Sorry. Cut that. So how did I feel? I think it was a similar sort of experience, similar emotions. Good to have the opportunity to practice.
I mean, from our side, I think that Viva was certainly technically a lot more difficult than the first Viva. And it's also because, you know, the topics that we ask are not as common. We ask about heparin, we ask about intracellular, extracellular ions. These are quite sort of, peripheral topics that we're trying to make that, some examiners will ask. And if you don't know much about it, it can be quite difficult. Mm. Yeah.
And that was one of the challenges, really. I remember knowing so much about so many things, but then in the actual exam, they started asking me about stuff that I thought, wow, the luck of the draw on the day means that I may have not revised this because we've got such a broad amount of knowledge to learn. And I thought it was really great that you had this broad knowledge. And even though you might have not known the exact numbers for certain things, you still talked about it to a passing level. And just remember, we cannot know everything about every topic. And I think you handled these really esoteric topics like intracellular potassium and nerve's potential, really well, considering that, we probably just don't have the time to get into this in a lot of detail. Whereas ketamine, absolutely, you got lots of time. Mm. Nitrous oxide, lots of time. We use it every day, or we can see it every day, and we should know that back to front.
Correct. And so, the key thing now is just to have a think about all the questions that were asked and the questions that you thought you struggled in, and really go back and review them. And so the next time when you get asked, you know, how does protamine work, you know. So, you know, you know, protamine, a cationic peptide that binds heparin and just stops that from functioning. And you'll actually know that for next time. So it's really good that we do these vivas. And so, you know, you this is where you sort of pick holes and then you go back and you cover them.
Yeah. And another thing that I think we did pretty effectively, every time we received a viva, we then gave that viva to someone else. So not only was someone else getting the benefit of the viva, but we got to practice again and practice being an examiner and thinking about what we would have asked and what the other person missed or did well, copying their techniques again.
Yeah. I really like that. I really like that idea about asking the same question to another person. And so as the, you know, you're the examiner now and you get to actually experience that side of things and actually share your knowledge and also consolidate your knowledge at the same time as well. All right. Now, just a couple of things. We're just going to go through some of the questions. So we've talked about protamine, heparin. Otherwise, everything else was really good. And you sort of had the technique where there were a couple of concepts which needed clarifying. And, you know, with the way that you were able to navigate through the viva, you were actually able to get them. So, you know, the one of the examples was the warfarin. So initially you said that we're actually stopping warfarin because of its duration of action, as in we wait for 3 to 5 days for the offset to happen. But the offset is actually due to the coagulation factor's half-lives rather than warfarin itself.
Yes.
And so, you know, you were able to get to that concept well. And then in the extracellular ion stems, it's potassium that has the main contribution to resting membrane potential. And you were actually able to work that out because of your knowledge about what the nurse potential was for sodium potassium. Yep. So that was really good. And the way that the mechanism in which hyperkalemia causes all those ECG changes was well described. And just to sort of clarify, when you have hyperkalemia, you hypopolarize a cell, okay? As opposed to when you have low potassium, you hyperpolarize a cell. Now, the issue with high potassium and hyperpolarizing a cell is, yes, you make it certainly more excitable, but what it does is when you're starting off from a resting membrane potential, your action potential is actually slowed or reduced. And that's what causes, you know, your prolongation of your PR interval, you know, the production of sine waves. That's the mechanism on how hyperkalemia affects the ECG. Okay?
Perfect. Okay, thank you for clarifying.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. And then, what do you thought about yours?
And so, with the placenta question, again, I thought you really answered it quite well because some of this stuff was stuff that you don't think about with the placenta that often, like the function of the placenta. You know, you went through the fact that it's, you know, sort of gas transfer, metabolic transfer, endocrine function, and immunological function, and you said that pretty quickly. And then what are the mechanisms of transfer? And you pretty quickly said there's simple diffusion. You're probably thinking about gases in that situation. You gave the example of facilitated diffusion, which is often, you know, cephalosporins and glucocorticoids are in that mechanism. And then active transport as well as pinocytosis. So just having, you know, even if you didn't know exactly the answer, you could work through the general principles of transfer and maybe extrapolate to the fact that the placenta probably does some of these as well. So I thought that was really good that you got most of that. And then the factors affecting oxygen transfer. I think you could have got this stuff across probably a bit quicker just to keep it going, but essentially you got all the points. There's the fact that fetal hemoglobin binds, there's a higher amount of fetal hemoglobin, there's a decent gradient, 100 to 20 millimeters of mercury of the pressure gradient of oxygen, as well as having, you know, the cardiac output effects of it, and the 600 mils per minute to the uterus by the uterine artery, as well as the double bore effect. And with a bit more time, I would have gone into the double bore effect. But yeah, again, handled really well. And then Stemate. So yeah, I thought your definitions and understanding of dead space were great. So the fact that you gave a really decent definition, how to minimize it, and then knowing these definitions in respiratory physiology seem like one of those crucial things to get through quick, easy parts of the viva, you know, nice and quickly. And then your ability to actually...
Do you think I did that well enough?
I think so. I think you did.
Okay, good.
And Pat, just to follow on a point, one of the mechanisms or one of the techniques you said to reduce alveolar dead space was high tidal volumes, low respiratory rate. So it is correct in a way in terms of that reduces your peak alveolar pressures, and one of the causes of dead space is high alveolar pressures. But you need to be careful when you use the word high tidal volumes, because you know, if you increase your volumes, you're going to increase your alveolar pressure. So
true.
You know, the idea is about just reducing alveolar pressures, as well as increasing, as you correctly noted, your perfusion pressure. Okay.
Great.
But you were able to describe the Bohr equation effectively. You know, actually knowing the formula, and you don't need to know the derivation of this formula. I wouldn't imagine, but that was great that you could do that and know about the modifications. And often in this exam, previous examiners have often asked me how we measure certain things. The fact that you know you use the arterial CO2 as the Enghoff modification, ENGHOFF, as well as the fact that you can use a Douglas bag to get the mixed expired CO2 tension. So that, again, very, very good. And, I was very pleased with my...
Well done, Pat.
Oh, thanks very much, guys. Thanks for the opportunity to do it.
No, that's right. I suspect we'll...
That's good.
I think, yeah, what we've heard from people is they really want more of these kind of Viva-style things, more practical stuff. So, yeah, thanks for your time. And I guess we can probably close on here. Yeah.
And you know what? If the audience wants some more, you know, email us.
That's right. LahiraandStan@gmail.com. And like we said in the last episode, what we can do is we can even narrow things down for certain pharmacology topics. Anything would be useful for us to examine people in life situations, give feedback, and it'll help a lot of the other listeners as well, especially leading up to the Viva. And then you've got a whole bank of Vivas on our podcast that you can always listen to in a very practical way. That's probably all for now. So please write into us. Please share and subscribe with anyone who might be interested in pharmacology, physiology, who is just interested in doing better at this exam. And thanks very much for listening. See you all next time.